Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Jesse David Fox. Hey, thank you for listening. While we are very hard at work to bring the show back with new episodes in a couple months, we wanted to share with you another episode from our archive that we really loved. This time with a special treat, but more on that in a minute. This first season interview with stand-up writer, actor, author Moshe Kasher was a really exciting one for me. Besides really enjoying Moshe's comedy, which resembles fellow Bay Area comedian Robin Williams in its alacrity and mania and arm hair, although he tends to be a bit more pointed, this was the first time where we had actual examples of a joke in different times in its development. This is because before Moshe told his joke, Heaven and Hell, on his 2013 Netflix special Live in Oakland, he told a really basic version in his 2009 album, Everyone You Know Is Gonna Die and Then You Are. So before the interview, we'll play both, giving you a sense of just how much an idea can grow when a comedian plays with it for a few years. After the interview, we've got that special treat I was talking about a minute ago. On January 25th, Moshe is putting out an album with his unique take on crowd work called Crowd Surfing, which captures just how quick his comedy is. He really is just so fast. And we at Good One Podcast are happy to premiere one of the standout tracks, The Story of DJ's Mom. It is wild! So here is Moshe Kasher.
I went to Barcelona. I went to Spain, and I got to tell you, I believe in God, but like I recognize that it's a little ridiculous to do so. You know, like I hate talking about God. Like I hate talking to Christians about God. Christians are the worst people to talk about God because they're so like, oh, it's all about us. You know, it's like Christian. If you don't hang out with us, you're gonna go to hell. If you don't become a Christian, you're going to hell. It's like the ironic twist of that is if I envision what hell would look like for me personally, it's definitely hanging out with Christians for all eternity. Right? I mean, that's not pleasant. Like, oh, I play a harp with the biggest loser in the world. And what do you play? Your contemporary Christian rock for me? Doesn't this sound nice? No, it fucking doesn't sound nice. Why do you think that this is music that will compel people to join your religion? This is clear evidence that God hates you. It's just the worst music. It's not good music. It's not. Anyway, here's a way to think about it. You don't go to hell for laughing at the jokes. I go to hell for writing them. And I was gonna go there anyway because I'm a Jew. That's where we end up. I didn't make that rule up. That's a Christian rule. I'm just reporting it back to you. And let me clarify, I'm not anti-Christian. I think Christians are very, very friendly people. They help you move. I think that's very important. Hey, buddy, you wanna do some service? But that's their thing, isn't it? It's heaven and hell. Like, every religion has its themes that it works with, you know? Like, the Buddhists have tofu and marijuana. The Jews have gold and money. The Muslims have submission and high-grade explosive. We all have our thing. And the Christian thing is heaven and hell. Like, only we get to go to heaven. Everybody else has to go to hell. Tough rule, I know. Born lucky, I guess. But the ironic twist of that rule is if I envision what my own personal hell looks like, it's definitely hanging out with nothing but Christians for all eternity.
listening to contemporary Christian rock music. Why? Why? Why would they think that that's music that would compel people to join their religion? If you play it backward, you can hear God screaming, "No! Not in my name." I mean, they had beautiful Christian music. That's the thing I don't understand. They had the most beautiful religious music ever was Christian music, like gospel music and Byzantine chanting, like, ah. Now it's like, me and Jesus eat a sandwich in the back of my pickup truck. Okay. I guess I'll join up then, based on your pithy little song. But I don't even care, actually. I don't care about getting into heaven because heaven doesn't sound that much greater than hell in comparison. I don't want to go to hell, but I don't feel like they've gone into enough detail about how awesome heaven will be in comparison to the volumes of detail of how terrible hell will be. Like, I would like you to give me more information. Give me, I want specific information on the prizes that I win when I get to heaven. I want to know. There's an endless fountain of gin and Oxycontin in the center of town. And you no longer have addiction issues, so drink up, buddy. I want to know, there's a free Cadillac Escalade for everyone in heaven, and you don't look weird driving them if you're white. I want to know. But all they do is tell you about the negative parts of hell. Like, if you've read Dante's Inferno, which I have because I'm smarter than all of you, you will know that there are very intricate descriptions of what hell is like. Like, the first, there's layers. So like, the first layer is a river of boiling shit that you swim in for 1,000 years. Then the second layer, you eat rust for 1,000 years. Then the third layer, you shit the rust out into a riverbed. It's very painful. I'm like, I'm totally convinced. I don't want to go. What do I get if I'm good? What do I get in heaven? They're like, a harp. A harp? Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it would be like if you sacrifice the important things you need to sacrifice in life in order to get to heaven, like marijuana and anonymous blowjobs, and you get up there? And it's exactly how they envisioned it for you in the cartoons. Like, hey, welcome to heaven. Here's your harp. You're like, oh, this was real. Okay. Yeah, I always imagined this was some sort of metaphor. No? Okay. You're going to give it a good college try because you got into heaven after all. You're a good person. You go, I guess I'll hang in there, see what happens. 5,000 years goes by. I'm still plucking. Is this it? Is this all there is to heaven? No, there's one more treat. You get to hang out with your family forever. Oh, that sounds great. You remember the last time you spent the afternoon with your mom? Yeah, you remember that moment when you're like, I gotta get out of here now! That's when forever begins. With your mom on the cloud next to you, looking over at you, complaining about your harp playing skills. How you don't play the harp that great anyway. How your brother used to get straight A's when he played the harp. Nobody wants to see you on stage telling jokes!
I'm here with the man behind that joke, Mr. Moshe Kasher.
The man behind the harp.
Man behind the harp. That's your title.
I haven't heard that joke in years. I would say that joke was a career-defining joke. But the first clip you played, man, I was really shocked with how half-baked it was.
It's so rare do we have such discrete versions of the joke to kind of reference.
Yeah.
The first one's from your first album, which came out in 2009, but I feel like it was recorded in 2008. And then the other one was from your first special, which came out in 2013. So, you know, it's like I'm really interested in those 4 years.
So in the original joke, you have the main point, which is your idea of hell is what people think heaven is.
Yes.
And there's the harp part and Christian rock is bad.
Right.
but there's not,
not even
like
what? Like a punchline? Is that the word you're looking for? Look, I can tell what was happening in there. I realized it re-listening to it. I had a nascent idea for a bit, and I was feeling myself. That's what it was. It was my first album. Things were going really good. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try soft-shoeing some stuff. Because like the Barcelona bit, I remember doing it. I don't think I've told it ever before or since. It wasn't really a bit. It was just kind of like a story of something I saw in Barcelona. And that was the setup to that thing. And I was just kind of like freewheeling, doing my thing. But I will say that I have always been fascinated with the notion that one of the main facets of Christian dogma is that they are the only ones that get to heaven. Because as far as I know, they're really the only religion that believes that. So that was always a fascination of Christian dogma, is that they could believe that.
So, but you kept on doing it. So after you performed it then, you must have known like the joke isn't finished. So what were you thinking about the section of the material, you know, kind of going forward?
I clearly knew it wasn't done because it became truly that bit, as you could hear, it was long and sophisticated. And not to toot my own horn or pluck my own harp, but, you know, it turned into a really like highly structured kind of big, meaty bit. Yeah. It became, yeah, like the backbone of my set was that. And I remember also being really struck when I read Dante's Inferno in college about how intricate the detail structure was. So I remember like always wanting to do something about that, like how much detail they went into. And then I guess I thought about the vagueness and the kind of cartoonishness of what the vision of heaven was. Like, truly, that's all that they really give you is like you spend time with the people you love. It's paradise. And then the harp thing is obviously an absurd caricature of what people think. Yeah,
harps are a good example of that. You know, it's interesting. It's interesting because it's like we have just that line, and not only do you build out, but everything you build out, you then, you know, build out. It's like you have this seed of this joke, and it has branches out, and then those branches have branches.
Oh, that's interesting. It's kind of a tangential festival.
Yeah, because it's like, oh, I have this Christian rock sentence. Yeah. I could do a full minute on Christian rock. Or, you know, over the course of those 4 years, you know, how is your process, you know, in maturing a thing like this?
Well, I think part of the problem of comedians doing specials every year, for me anyway, is like, you know, when the masters do it, it's like, okay, I guess go for it, you know. But when people feel the need to do it and they aren't at the like top of the top level, I think bits don't get to cook long enough. And sometimes, you know, that bit clearly needed to cook. It took 4 years to really fully perfect and master and get it to the point that it was like a full. I actually remember that there were parts of that bit that didn't make it in. The song originally was longer. Yeah, me and Jesus eat a sandwich in the back of my pickup truck. Let me see if I can remember the lyrics of the full version. It was not funny. I will warn you. I mean, it was kind of funny, but it was very stupid. It was me and Jesus eat a sandwich in the back of my pickup truck. But I was so hungry. Eat a manwich. I don't know. But Jesus, he just didn't give a fuck. And I was so something that I looked down. And Jesus, wait, I was so sad that I looked down. Something. I don't know. There was this whole longer version of the song that was. So I tried that a couple times. People were like, "What? So hungry, eat a manwich?" Was there a semicolon in there? Like, anyway, me and Jesus eat a sandwich. What was at any rate, the song at some point was longer. And I, you know, what's the thing about? I can remember the thought that led to each part of the bit. You know, I remember being the idea that Christians, Born Lucky, I guess. Was from my stepfather, my mother's second husband, has family that are evangelical Christians. And I remember they always, it was like every time we'd go visit them, it would be this like, because my brother is religious, and it would be this like, you know, sort of ecumenical council of like, you know, back and forth. And I asked them, I remember the kids, like, well, how do you, just I remember being really fascinated by this idea of like the justification that Christians can have of being born into a family that allows the belief in their faith to be so easy, whereas a person who's born into a Muslim or pagan or Amazonian family must overcome all of the circumstances of their birth in order to get to faith. Why are they so virtuous that they get such an easy path to heaven? And, you know, the Yanomami people in Brazil, you know, they have to like not only find out about Christianity, but then believe in it and then become it. And I remember it really kind of threw them for a loop too. So I was like, I thought that was a funny line, Born Lucky, I guess.
The one line that is in both is the sort of thesis of the joke. You say different things, but they're slightly different. I will read back and you can tell me how intentional it was or was not.
This feels like a deposition.
I know, right?
In 2009, you say. Now, the ironic twist of that is, if I envision what hell would look like, for me personally, it's definitely hanging out with Christians for all eternity. And then in 2013, it goes, the ironic twist of that rule, if I envision what my own personal hell looks like, it's definitely hanging out with nothing but Christians for all eternity.
It's softened a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I realized in the beginning it was a lot harsher, too. It just sounded a little bit more... I mean, the bit's harsh, and it's a little... you know, I do this arrogant guy on stage, so I'm not a soft comedian. But I, in the beginning, probably because it was undeveloped, it just sounded like a bunch of, you know, just horrible attacks.
Yeah, it's also much more conversational. But, you know, did you intentionally change the wording of it, or do you think it just, like, as your persona was sort of coming into focus, the words kind of followed?
I think that, no, I did not intentionally change it, but I think it's more precise. You know, if I was to talk about what my own personal hell would look like, I think that's a more interesting and colorful idea. And then nothing but Christians for all eternity, I think, is a more soft and less harsh reality. It's like, you know, the first part is... just, I don't want to be around Christians. Yeah. That's what that sounds like. Yeah. And that's not it. And in fact, I softened it further, right?
Yeah.
Which is, I'm not anti-Christian. I'm not. I think Christians are very friendly people. They help you move.
Yeah.
I think that's very important. Yeah.
It sort of like brings them back in.
Yeah, because the reality of a stand-up comedian touring through the country is the 2/3 of the people that you're performing in front of are Christians. Yeah. So you have to find a way to get them to laugh the whole time. Yeah. And they can. You know, there's a lot of little back and forths, pushes and pulls, like... terrible Christian music. You had great music.
Yes.
There was great music. There was this beautiful gospel. And so it's really, it becomes about the specifics of the absurdity of the music and the absurdity of the specific dogma.
Another specific, and this may be even more absurd to bring up, but in a earlier version, when you're talking about harps, you're like, you have to sacrifice marijuana. And in the earlier version, you go, and going to raves. And now in the recorded version, it is... marijuana and anonymous blowjobs. So why is blowjobs funnier than raves?
Okay, so that's the worst question you've asked so far. I think that's pretty obvious.
Yes.
No, I guess raves actually technically is could be thought of as slightly funnier. But first of all, I think that's a callback to another joke.
It's possible. The clip, because the clip doesn't show...
I think it is, because there's another joke that I do about... another true Kasher classic about how I would rather be gay, about how awesome being gay is, because, and it's this whole bit about anonymous cruising parks.
Yes.
How amazing it is that there's a bush. You can walk up, there are certain parks you can walk up to a bush, any bush, and there's a man inside of that bush waiting to give you a blowjob, right? He doesn't care what you look like. He's just waiting in there like a duck waiting for its foie gras feeding tube. Blah, 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 blah.
Sure, sure.
So the point of it all is, sorry to, I know people are blushing right now. The point of, I think that that's what I was getting at, was that's you're giving up that thing, that awesome thing that we discussed earlier. It's a mini callback, because it's not like usually a callback. I've never been very good at callbacks.
Yeah.
But usually a callback gets you this big, like, oh, no, he didn't.
In between the two, you wrote and released your memoir, Kasher and the Rye, which you've said is the thing that you're most proud of.
That's true.
What did you learn?
Although I just reheard that bit and I'm feeling...
now.
I'm leaning towards that bit.
Yeah. What did you learn about writing and writing comedy, and how did your comedy change just from the fact that you wrote that and also the process of writing that?
Well, you know, what I wrote in that book was very different stylistically than what I, obviously, than the stand-up. I mean, first of all, when I was a young man, when I was a kid, I never dreamed of being a stand-up comedian, but I did dream of writing a book. And when I got the book deal, I was very interested in writing a book that wasn't, as I call them, take a shit books. Mm-hmm. You know, these, like, a lot of these comedians, you read their book and it's like, oh, okay, so you got like a book deal, and then you just like were like, I gotta fill in 200 pages. What should I do here? I wasn't interested in doing that. I really wanted to like give, also because it was my life story. It wasn't just like a humorist, you know, little here's some bits. But so that was a whole other process than stand-up ever was. It was sitting down 2 pages a day. That's how I did it. I would try to write 2 pages a day, and if I missed a day, I'd write 4. And, you know, also there was this whole process of memory, which was really interesting as far as memoirs go, that, like, memory is such an interesting thing. As I say in the foreword of the book, is like, you don't know how many memories you have until you stop, turn around, and dive into the dark, cold water of your deep memories. And the more you get in there, the more you realize, whoa, I remember all these things that are kind of which is weird. It's like, what are they doing in your brain? If they're there and you never access them and never use them, what are they doing down there? But I definitely was able to do that. But I was also very concerned in making sure that it was a comedy book. And I thought that the comedy in that book, I learned two things. One was that comedy is a really beautiful vehicle to transport sincerity and emotionality in on. So a lot of what I think the power of that book is, there are certain jokes, actually, if I could, I would go in and take out. If I could do another edition, I would take certain jokes out that were a little too jokey and a little too crass. But generally, the book, I feel like, is laugh out loud funny until all of a sudden you get to like the middle and you're like, oh, wait a minute, what's happening here? And then by the end, you're like, oh, no, you've been sort of almost hoodwinked into coming into like a dark story, which I think is pretty powerful.
So the first album you recorded probably like 7 or 8 years in
to comedy. You said it was 2008.
It was 2009. It was released. I feel like it's probably recorded in 2008.
Probably six years in.
Yeah. And then so then the special was about 10 years in. Mm-hmm. You were an incredibly different performer between the two things. Like the first one is so much slower and you're like, there's ums. I remember not in this joke, but in other ones, there's like, you almost have like a Mitch Hedberg cadence, which is not something that I associated with. Because listening back, I was like, this is not.
That's interesting.
But it's the kind of thing I think like everyone kind of did at that point. And then you're so much faster. Everything is. How did that change? Were there certain moments in those 4 years where you kind of like.
When did I become a fast talking Jew? That's a good question. Yeah, I think that as time went on, my bits started to become longer and longer and longer. And that became part of like the signature of who I was as a performer, which isn't great.
Yeah.
Well, it's great, but it's not like there's certain things it's really not made for, like late night TV.
Yeah.
I'm not like built for that because, you know, that's my, you know, that was my signature bit. That's what, a 6 minute bit or something like that. And, you know, I got a bit in my, I don't know if I can even call it a bit. It's like in my next special that I will be doing, which is probably 20 minutes long. So, I mean, it's a long story and it goes, it like spins off to this bit and then comes back to the original story. But that I think happened pretty organically. I think that I do remember one breakthrough bit for me. It's actually kind of a hacky bit, but it was in terms of structure, it became a really a breakthrough bit, which is about dating profiles on MySpace. Okay, just to date things.
yeah.
And it was a little bit mean and harsh. I wouldn't like want it on TV.
Yeah.
But it was a thing that had like all these different, like started one place, went to another, became this long story. It's something about like, apparently there's a little bit of confusion about what you're picture on your profile is supposed to look like. It's supposed to look like what your fucking face looks like.
Yeah.
Not some magic trick you played on a camera to fool it into thinking you were attractive. I mean, it's harsh. Yeah. It was a harsh joke. Yeah, I'm not saying it's not harsh. But I had all these like little intricate details, like, you know, what was it, to fool it into thinking you were attractive? The butter, something about butter on the lens, and you know, you put the camera up on the first day of the spring equinox, right? When the sun hits the keyhole. Which was a Hobbit reference.
Sure.
And it just became this bit of like deepest intricacy. And it kept going and got harsher and harsher. But the point of it all was, I thought that was a breakthrough bit for me in terms of the way that I wrote jokes, which is this unique style, I think, of like these hyper dense, you know.
Was it partly that because it seemingly was like a hack-ish concept? I mean, if you did it today with like, because now everyone doing internet dating jokes, but... Is it that like, oh, I need to make sure that this joke is at least somewhat interesting, or is it just like,
I don't know. I'm not positive it was a hack concept at the time.
Yeah.
Right. I think that, or maybe it's possible that it was. And this idea, because it was the early days of MySpace where, I mean, the idea stems from not a groundbreaking idea, which is you get a picture from someone and you go meet them and you're like.
Yeah. But I guess less people are meeting each other in MySpace.
That's true. Yeah. And I remember there was a rhetorical device in there that was literally designed to get me laid. Literally. And it would go, it was like, you know, I've some online dating, myspace.com/Moshe Kasher, find me, fuck me. That's literally what I said. And of course, it literally worked at certain points. So this dates me. Anyway, I'm not saying I'm particularly proud of the bit, but it spoke to my process as a comedian. This like fast talking, rapid fire kind of juggernaut train of bit.
The sort of other two things which you touch on a little bit, which is if you've read Dante's Inferno, which I have because I'm smarter than you,
right?
Which very early on you make that claim, even though at first you assume they have read Dante's Inferno. And then sure. The other, you know, and there's just sort of that anger. Like, you're aware that you want to feel like you're condescending or not condescending to an audience. Are you trying to communicate anger to the audience?
Definitely the condescension is deliberate and only works when the crowd is in love with the idea that this, like, vulnerable idiot, mm-hmm. brilliant idiot, or whatever character it is that I'm doing on stage is this, like, you know, I always call it like highbrow, lowbrow. Yeah. That's like that's the area I really love. It's like I'm talking about stupid things smartly or smart things stupidly.
Yeah.
And so the bit, obviously, if people think that I think that I'm smarter than all of them, it's not going to be a good night at the office, right? But if everybody recognizes the inherent kind of like vulnerability of a person, stupid vulnerability of a person saying that the fact they read Dante's Inferno in college means they're smarter than everybody in the room is that, you know, that if they get a laugh there, I'm in a good zone.
Yes. They're like, cause essentially you're saying they have to think of you as low status so that you're trying to be high status.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Not that you're like, yeah, I'm a high status person. I'm just like coming here and be like.
And anyone who thinks that I'm being serious when I say that, and I've had obviously every internet comment available, it's like they hate me because they think I'm literally going, I'm smarter than all of you. It's like, they literally, I mean, I am literally saying that.
Yeah.
But anytime I'm saying I'm amazing on stage, it's probably because I mean like, I'm not.
Yes. You know, it's Jewish history and comedy is tremendous. American comedy is really like half Jewish, half black in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your relationship to the history of Jewish comedy, history of Jews in comedy, the history of comedy about Jews?
I think that Judaism is a big part of my background, obviously, and my reality. And the way that I interact with Judaism mostly is through things like that. I find it really interesting. I must, because I keep doing it, to lambast the absurdity of anti-Semitism or things that I find hateful by just saying them directly as if they are self-evident truths. Because I think that, to me, that's the biggest way to lampoon that, right? And I've gotten in trouble. Trouble's not the right word, but like people, again, if they think it's real, people go like, yo, what are you doing? You know, like, so I always thought that like anti-Semitism, racism in general is so completely absurd that the funniest way to point out the absurdity is to interact with it as if it's like, it is true.
I believe how a comedian frames their set is important, right? So, and there's a certain expectations that an audience would have, especially when you're starting out or even if they don't know who you are, that Moshe Kasher is like, oh, it's a Jewish comedian.
Yeah, right. And you expect more.
Yes.
The more like, so my allergies, that kind of.
Where it's like Mark Kasher, I think most people would be like, oh, I have no reading on what this person's going to be.
Yes,
and he's,
right.
And you have no way of confirming or defying an expectation. You're just like neutral. How do you think the fact that you're introduced as Moshe Kasher on stage opposed to Mark Kasher on stage would essentially has affected your career in some way?
I didn't change my name for comedy, obviously.
Yeah.
Although I used to make a joke about it. I used to be called, like, I don't know, whatever, Mark Smith, but I jewed it up to make it in showbiz. I changed my name for, I guess, like, identity and spiritual. I mean, I didn't change my name. It's my middle name.
Yeah.
And my father never called me anything but Moshe. My brother never called me anything but Moshe. But the ownership of my name also was about the custody dispute with my mother. Mm-hmm. And that became a sort of polarized argument in the house. Like, she only called me Mark, but my father only called me Moshe and the whole thing. And when I was 16 and sort of getting in touch with my spiritual side and starting to go to raves and be myself and go to, went to 12-step groups and stuff. Raves and 12-step groups.
Yes, of course.
A classic combination. I finally was like, okay, this is my true reality of who I am. And then years later, I started doing comedy.
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, it's like you are Moshe Kasher.
That's
true.
And
like your comedy is based in the truth that is the same truth that is you being that.
And at the same time, I am the kid that was raised in Oakland, in Oakland public schools. I'm not some like guy that's like, I buy chai dye. I'm an American kid from a secular city.
You mentioned the use of Jewish stereotypes. And I think a lot of Jewish people have that. Like, I think there's a long tradition of Jewish people kind of deflating Jewish stereotypes. I mean, as a person that has a family that does it, I know, at least I'm aware of it. But you, as you said, you've toured the country. Do you notice, do you care if people are laughing at the wrong part of it in the classic, they're laughing at the wrong part of the joke.
I mean, I don't know how I would know, except I will say that I will have often had people come up to me after the show. Because one problem with being that comedian, that Jewish comedian that leans into the stereotype as a way of like deflating it, as you say, is that, you're right. Not everybody gets the deflation. They just think it's funny on its face, you know? And so they'll come up to you after the show. I mean, this is so classically true. They come up to you after the show like, hey, you want to hear my best Jew joke? And the answer is a resounding no.
Yeah.
100% of the time. I mean, and it's not even like a questioning no. Is it? No, I did not. And guess what happens 100% of the time? I hear that joke.
Yeah.
I've never not heard that joke. And it is as bad as you think.
Yeah.
But speaking of jokes, I'm reminded that perhaps that whole bit stems from a very early street joke that I heard like when I was a little kid, which I always was really tickled with. And it's about a guy dies and goes to heaven. And I actually, the original version of the joke is about Catholics versus Protestants, but I'll just make it a little more universal, make it all religions. A guy dies and goes to heaven, and St. Peter or whoever is showing him around, and they walk past a room, and there's a bunch of like people in the lotus position, like going om, and St. Peter's like, yeah, that's where the Buddhists are. And they keep walking, there's some people bowing before an elephant statue, like that's the Hindus, they're Indian, that's where they are. And then they go a little further, and there's some Jews shuffling back and forth, like those are the Jews over there. And then there's this huge wall, this giant wall, and the guy's like, well, who's in there? And St. Peter's like, shh, that's the Christians. They think they're the only ones in here.
We'll be back with more Moshe Kasher.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
We're back with Moshe Kasher. So continuing with kind of that section of the joke, if you'll indulge me, and I think this will be a good way to plug your TV show, sure. Problematic and Problematic Jokes, I want to talk about offensiveness and its use in comedy and its not use. And this is not me coming from the perspective of I'm offended by jokes.
Sure.
I tend to not be offended by any jokes, but I'm aware that it exists. You know, in that section where you kind of, there's a part where you go like, oh, heaven, hell is Christians things and Buddhist things is marijuana and something else.
Tofu and marijuana.
So marijuana and Jews is money and then
gold money. And Muslims then,
So.
Listen, I felt it time stamping itself.
Oh, interesting.
You know what I mean? In that moment when I go, Muslims are submission and high grade explosive, I was thinking to myself, oh, I wonder, I don't think I could tell that joke anymore. I don't think that we're in the zone where that joke would fly.
But I think in general, you know, why? You know, why do a joke that has a stereotype that some people might be offended by? Like what, and beyond just like, oh, it's funny, because you can make jokes about anything. But like, you know, what is it?
I mean, to be honest, like that was it.
Yeah.
I was just looking for the hardest punchline that was available to me at that time. Now, I've never been a particularly like shy away from a thing because it's a offensive comedian. I've also, you know, I never have been a person that's like, I'm combing my bit to try to find the edgiest zone that I can just, you know, hurt everybody. So But why tell that joke that way? I don't know. Can you think of a better punchline?
I mean, not right now. But it's hard to know because it's like the joke is built around to have sort of whatever the harshest thing is because you're getting increasingly.
Exactly.
And then you put the Jewish thing first. So it's a sort of like we're all in good fun thing. But it's interesting because it's like I think there is a certain sort of raising the stakes that those jokes have. And mm-hmm. if everyone agrees we're in good fun, then you're like, cool, he's raised the stakes. But I always am curious because for a joke to raise the stakes, it has to assume that someone is offended.
That's interesting. I never thought of it like that.
Because
there is a bit on that album that's like the ground rules bit, you know,
yeah,
which is like,
right before. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Something like, if you were offended, you know, I did a little thinking before my pre-show prayer and turns out I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
What was it?
It's like,
and
don't worry.
People come up to me and they'll come up to me and they'll say, I was very offended by what you said tonight. And I go, oh, well, I was just kidding the whole time, actually. Yeah. So, but that conversation has changed since that album came out, right?
Yeah.
Now there's this whole new conversation, which as a comedian, I got to say, I love, which is about like, you know, intent is not about, it does not equal impact. And, you know, that excuse won't fly anymore that you were kidding. You know, jokes are destructive and blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm not on board with that argument that jokes are destructive to humanity. I think that there are bigger issues. And I do not necessarily ascribe to the belief that jokes perpetuate violence and racism. I think that they lampoon them most of the time.
Yeah.
But. I'm not saying I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
I'm not a sociologist or an expert. And, you know, as I once heard Bill Maher say, a person who everybody finds very offensive,
yeah.
whatever is good for me as a citizen is bad for me as a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really interesting point. Like, I'll give an example of, like, if I were to tell that joke now, would I do the high grade explosive? I might just leave that part out. A religion has its thing. You could cut. That's a pretty easy trim. Yeah. Not because I necessarily think it shouldn't be told, although maybe I do. I haven't thought about it in a long time. I didn't even remember that line was in there.
Yeah.
But also, I don't think it would work.
Yeah.
I think it wouldn't work today. I think people would be like, hey, that's. Well,
that is part of it, which is like the idea that like the audience is always right, but audiences are too sensitive these days. It's like. The audience is the audience, right? You can't be like, be different people.
Well, I'll give you an example that I've been thinking a lot about lately. So the word faggot.
Yeah.
Or you can beep that if you do that. when I first started comedy, it was a very, very, very popular word for alternative comedians to use, straight alternative comedians to use about themselves.
Yes.
Right. It was always this like righteous, I'm on the right side of this conversation because it's always, and in fact, on this album, I have that thing that happened because it really was a situation that happened where these car full of guys rolled by. And they screamed faggot at me and my and three straight friends. And I remember being so amused by this dude who's like a big kind of tougher man going like, come back here and say that to my face. Like he was so angry. Yeah. And I was just like, those are just like dudes. Like they don't know you. Why is that bothering you? So it turned into this whole bit about I was gay bashed recently, but I'm not gay. Ha ha ha. And then I say faggot, but I'm always on the right, quote unquote. I'm doing air quotes for the podcast.
Sure. Listeners.
I'm on the right side of the argument. And it would always be this huge comedy word. Anytime you did that, big laugh. Everybody would love it. And then things started to develop and change. And then all of a sudden you would find diminishing returns with that word. And then eventually, I mean, look, I'm sure somebody does it and it's really great.
Yeah.
But I started to find that it was harder to go to that well. And now I don't say that. I don't think it's wrong that I should ever say it. I don't know. But it just doesn't really work as a comedy word. And I think that's probably a really good sign for humanity in general that we've all moved to the point where even a person on the right side, air quotes again, of that argument can't use that word. So good for me as a citizen, bad for me as a comedian.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also like, I think some comedians, and I don't necessarily think this is the case with you, but that there's that idea that comedy is agreement or like laugh as an agreement.
Yes.
But if you can get someone to laugh at something they don't agree with, it's just like an impressive feat for someone who does a lot of comedy.
I mean, Patrice O'Neill was the ultimate example. I used to watch Patrice in San Francisco, which was like, that's a truly great experience. Cause you know, some women would walk out, but then you'd have these leftover, like, you ostensibly probably feminist, demographically feminist women who just begrudgingly were sitting there going like, oh, I hate this, but it is funny.
Yeah.
You know, this is funny. Yeah. And Patrice was like the great articulator of that point. I am only on the side of funny. I have no agenda other than, is it funny?
Yeah.
And As a comedian, that's my primary agenda. As a like citizen and a progressive, I have other agendas. But when I get on stage, like, I don't really care about. I care about offending people only in as much as I don't want to hurt people's feelings in general as a human, and I don't want to alienate crowds as a comedian.
Yeah.
So I will tell the joke that it has integrity to me.
Kind of on the other side of that, which is, it ends up being kind of the second part of the joke, as the album is, you talk about YouTube comments to a version of the joke.
Uh-huh.
Which on a side note, you say recently that YouTube, that joke was on the front page of YouTube, but it was 3 years ago.
What's funny is when you analyze a joke this deeply, I start to see the bullshit parts. Like, yeah. My mom, yeah. I realized, like, oh, that's funny. Like, it's a very effective bit to say your mother on the car. Everybody loves it, but it was just couldn't be further from the truth. I was recently on the front page of YouTube. I just said recently, everybody, the funniest part about stand-up is when somebody goes, a crazy thing happened to me today, and a comedian in the back of the room will always look to his comedian buddy and be like, I don't think that happened today. This bit's a little too developed for this to have happened today.
The only time, and I think maybe I've seen it since, Hannibal, I think on his first or second album, goes, 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago when I started writing this bit.
That's great. That's really a nice, like, deconstruction of that phenomenon. Yeah.
So, and I assume you said recently the first time. You're like, well, recently is the word that starts this bit.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. These bits, they become codified without your consent.
Yeah.
You know, you look back and you go, that's how I know how to make it funny is with this rhythm. And if I try to undo the rhythm, it's like.
And why? Like, who cares?
Right. I don't know, but it's real.
You know, I think with YouTube comments, I think in general, and I, you know, what inspired you to have that portion of that sort of coda to the joke, which is like you making fun of these people that are making fun of you?
Well, I mean, it's not terribly sophisticated. The bit went on YouTube, and it was the first thing I ever had even go mildly viral. You know, it's hundreds of thousands of views before that was a commonplace occurrence, and I was really excited by that. And of course, it's a divisive bit, obviously. And so I like, and this was before I learned the lesson, never read the comments, although maybe I should read the comments because it turned into a classic bit. But the comments were so funny to me. All those comments are totally real. And I just found them so funny. I mean, the one where he says black people is just like so weird. That was one of the comments. Just black people. Just black people.
Yeah.
No further commentary.
I mean, you know, comments are an extreme example of this, but I think now knowing kind of the career that you've had since it, and I think it's interesting when stand-ups do that, is like a stand-up or comedy that tries to create conversations or trying to be a conversation. I think some stand-ups try to think as if they're having a conversation with the audience, but the audience isn't speaking.
Mm-hmm.
With that, with Hound Tall, your podcast, with Problematic, you know, what is your relationship to your stand-up as a frozen thing that is just you monologuing and or you and your desire to have people kind of be talking about the things that you're talking about?
Well, have you ever seen me live?
Yes.
I mean, I would say my road show or whatever is probably 40 to 60% crowd interaction.
Yeah.
With this backbone of the material coming in to kind of lay the firmament of the show. So that's how I enjoy to perform. I was thinking to myself listening to that clip, I was like, damn, this crowd is insanely hot, by the way. I mean, I was like, wow,
the loudest crowd that I think I've ever
heard. It's real good. It's part of that is the acoustics of the space. Part of that is that there was no people there. I bombed terribly and we put Seinfeld's laughs in after. But
I do think all specials should have louder laughs.
Yeah, it sounded great. I was thrilled, and I was sensually remembering what happened that night. It was such a good night of comedy for me. But anyway, because it was my special, I was kind of monologuing, and I can do that because I have these long bits. But really, how I enjoy doing my act is really interacting with the crowd, because I think crowds have a lot of stories to tell. And if I always say if I don't find that story, it's because I didn't find it, not because it wasn't there. With my show, you know, part of the show's premise is that the crowd can get involved and can be part of the thing. They can ask questions Donahue style and they can get into the muck. I mean, basically the show is, you know, but the show's very different than my stand-up. The show is much more similar to my podcast, Sound Tall, where we get an expert on and get a panel of comedians to kind of riff over that expert, Mystery Science Theater style. As I call it, like a TED Talk meets Mystery Science Theater. And this is like a lot more like that. The show Problematic on Comedy Central, we delve into a very deep, substantive social issue topic, cultural appropriation, how the internet is changing your brain, Islam. And we try to make a comedy show about it, and we try to have real conversations about it.
you couldn't have been imagining one day I'm going to be this type of comedian who then would have this type of TV show. But
that's true.
So eventually this TV show had to be the TV show that you had. You know, what was, if you look at it, your career now as some sort of trajectory, not that you set out to do, but kind of post looking at it, what was it about the stand-up that you were doing that got you to this point?
The through line, now that I'm thinking of it, is highbrow, lowbrow. That's been the through brow. Yes. That's been the unibrow of my whole career, is talking about big things and smart things in a silly way and vice versa. And so you're right. When I started comedy, I got to tell you, like my first year of comedy, the idea that what I was doing in open mics and coffee shops in San Francisco had anything to do with what like Robin Williams was doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't even occur to me. Some people were more ambitious and motivated than me and they did see that line. I didn't. There was no connection. And then slowly I started to see that connection was there. And then I eventually like wanted that connection so much that I moved to LA. Again, like I said, I didn't grow up with dreams of being a stand-up. I grew up with other dreams, you know, and this kind of fell in my lap. But what I care about is having a good time and having fun and laughing. And I also really care about conversations and talking about concepts that are difficult and challenging and you know, interesting and unique. And I think the bit actually speaks to that. So that's what the show is. And that's what a lot of my stand-up is based around, is having a good time and kind of like talking to the top of people's intelligence while appealing to the base of their genitals.
You know, I watched some. Is the goal that someone leaves with an answer? Is the goal that people are entertained and then maybe they've taken away something? You know, what is the balance that you hope the show strikes, regardless of, you know, what it does? And obviously the show that's so specific takes maybe some time, mm-hmm. you know, but in 3 years, let's say it works and not, you know, what is working for something like this?
For my show, I'm not necessarily interested in like a rhetorical kind of answer. I think that a lot of shows have been working on, you know, the rhetorical answer of don't elect Donald Trump for a long time and it didn't really work.
Yeah.
So I'm not really trying to change the political landscape. I'm more trying to like delve into big conversations in a way that's fun. And the takeaway from anything, I hope, would be like that. Wow, that was really interesting. I know more about that topic than I did before, and I had a really nice time. Mm-hmm. And also I had a really fun time laughing at that topic. Yeah. And also, first of all, it's very difficult to get like a substantive takeaway in a 22-minute show. So what I think we've done in our show really well and nimbly is find a way to balance, you know, fast-paced comedy with like deep dives into sophisticated conversations that aren't boring for a Comedy Central audience. So I'm pretty excited actually about it. And what I want people to take away mostly, I guess, is that you can have conversations about any topic and that you shouldn't shy away from topics because they make you uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, in the episode I saw, the moment where you would like, here's the takeaway, and then you kind of don't do a clear answer, is the takeaway is not here's the answer to a thing, but here's the path to that thing. Now this, this seems really religious.
Now that you've looked into this, now, you know, I mean, there's no way for me to give you the answer in 22 minutes unless I'm like a prognosticator, like standing on a soapbox with a very specific agenda, which I don't necessarily have. I assume you're talking about the cultural appropriation episode. And that is a perfect example of something that doesn't really have a takeaway message, because cultural appropriation is a very difficult conversation to find an answer about. And I think that's the answer to that particular thing that we came to, is like, there isn't an answer here. Cultural appropriation most specifically is not about like, don't do this, do this. Although that's the framework of that conversation always. It's like the absurdity of a person going, don't borrow from culture, and then like you go eat Indian food, right? Yeah. So there's no way around that inherent like fatal flaw of the argument. And so really what we talked about in the episode is like, this isn't really about making rules. It's about understanding why people are upset.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think we did get somewhere cool with it. But yes, it's a 22-minute show, so we can only go
If you did have an answer, just the entire tone would be so like glib and like,
P.S. there was an answer bit that didn't make the final cut that, you know, I was into the message of it, but it just came off really sanctimonious.
Yeah.
You know, it was essentially this idea that, you know, some accusations of cultural appropriation are totally ridiculous. And you can look at a black guy and go, look, that dude's wearing khakis, and go, that's cultural appropriation, too. But to you, it's just khakis. right? It's not a thousand death by a thousand racist cuts. Sure. It's not a lifetime of weird indignities. It's just khakis, and khakis are cool, but they don't carry the weight of American history. Some version of that, but it came off a little bit like, I'm Mark Twain.
Yeah, and I think then it reverse frames the previous conversation as like devaluing the other viewpoints, which I think what's interesting is there's different point of views, and ultimately you talk to different people and their response to it will help give everyone a more nuanced understanding of this thing, which is ultimately the best case scenario.
My primary goal in this, and I've been thinking about this passage all week long from this in the AA big book. I don't know why that applies, but I've been thinking a lot about this passage, which is the line, to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. And it's talking about the process of resentment. And when you're angry at someone, all you ever do is think like, well, that person hurt me. And that's the end of the introspective period of this. But if you get past that part, then you can start to get into what's really going on. So that's what's really become of American discourse is all we do is go like, oh, but that person's wrong. And that's when we stop listening. And I really think that that's when we ought to start.
That sound means it's time for the laughing round, which is like a lightning round. But because it's comedy, it's a laughing round.
That's very clever.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
Funniest rap lyric you can think of. It doesn't have to be funniest ever. Just whatever one that comes to mind. So it's no pressure that people...
You know, one rap lyric I've always really appreciated from Too Short. As a white kid growing up in Oakland, you always really clung to these sorts of sentiments. Too Short once said, there's no such thing as an Oakland punk. It don't matter who you are, you'll be in the trunk. And I just prayed to that concept to be true for many years.
This one comes from a listener. He goes by Dusty Husky on Twitter, but that could be a name. Maybe it's Dustin. This is a version of a question. Do you have a joke that at any point that you're aware was bad or hack, and it might be still now that you kind of have and that you still do because it kills?
Well, I'll say this. There's a bit that I have right now that that the whole thing culminates in me saying mom, right? And I know that people have an issue with that framework. Mm-hmm. But it's this whole bit about the concept of the phrase, are you trying? And I set this whole long bit up about my mother and her lack of sexual boundaries. Now she brought me to like a vibrator shop when I was like young to buy me lesbian text-based erotica, rather lest I fall into the oppressive regime of pornography. This whole long bit about how inappropriate my mom is sexually. And then later I do this bit about, are you guys trying? And how invasive a question that is, you know, and how there's all this sexual backstory and it becomes very, very vulgar, you know, and, you know, you guys trying, you fucking a whole lot. It goes into this very vulgar thing. And then at the end it goes, yeah, mom, we're fucking trying. And I know that sometimes people are like, mom, but I'm like, that's the best end of the joke and it has integrity and I'm not willing to stop.
What's the first joke you can remember and the last joke that you're currently working on?
First stand-up joke that I did? It's actually on my special. I put it in there as a little Easter egg. It's the schizophrenic pride joke. That's the first joke that I ever wrote. It's this idea that homosexuality used to be considered a psychological aberration, but then we now realize that it isn't. How cool would it be if things that we currently think are psychological aberrations are a part of the framework of society 50 years from now? Specifically, how cool would schizophrenic pride weekend be?
That's like it's a sophisticated
high level first joke. The second joke you should have heard, though. I think that was something to do with, like, you ever notice when people burp, their burps smell like salami? That's why I've been eating nothing but salami. So the next time some punk motherfucker is like, that smelled like salami, I could be like, that's because it is. So, you know, I had a good first one. Then we did a deep, deep, deep fall from grace.
That is truly different. That is highbrow, lowbrow.
I think that might just be lowbrow.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can listen to Everyone You Know Is Going to Die and Then You Are wherever you stream music. And you can watch Live in Oakland on Netflix. Follow Moshe on social media at Moshe Kasher. Good One is produced by me with production assistance from Jelani Carter and Jordan Bell. Justin D. Wright did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One will be back in a couple months with new episodes. Until then, as promised, here's the track DJ's Mom from Moshe Kasher's upcoming album, Crowd Surfing.
Let's start easy, right? Anybody here have a sex? That's how a curious Italian man asks you if you're a virgin. Anybody here have a sex before?
Anybody like an apostle or a sex? Either one. It's a similar situation. This has been a character, horny Italian man, or as we could call him in shorthand, Italian man. The Italians are so horny. Anybody have a sex story? That I mean, I don't want to be. Oh, whoa! There's a. The creep has raised his hand. Very nice. The man who I referenced at the beginning, who demurred when I called him creepy simply for comedic effect. I'm going to do that every night that I record this album and blend all of the shows into one show. I'm going to pick a random person to be the creep to illustrate what I'm trying to do. So it doesn't mean that you're automatically a creep. But then I said, "Is anybody?" He's been raising his hand since Italy. He has been ready with a fettuccine Alfredo story when you made your own fettuccine Alfredo, sir. That's a cum joke, everybody. It looks similar, is I think what I'm trying to say. This guy knows what I'm talking about. What's your name, sir?
My name is DJ.
Okay, that's sick, dog. What, that's cool. What does this stand for?
Donald Joseph.
Oh, you sounded disappointed in yourself. This motherfucker has been thinking the words dick jockey his entire life. Walking into his mom's room. Why couldn't it have been dick jockey? She's like, "You're 11 years old, DJ. But someday." So Donald Joseph, you immediately raised your hand and you thought of a sex story. Well, tell me what, break it down for me. Give me some background. Where were we at?
So I was 18, living at home with my mother.
Oh yeah, the bitch. Donald Joseph, motherfucker, uncreative asshole.
I had my ex-girlfriend over, and we're getting hot and heavy, and...
You and your mom, or you and your ex-girlfriend? Okay, I don't know. You gotta set the stage better.
So, basically, my ex-girlfriend and I were getting hot and heavy in the bedroom, and we found...
When you say hot and heavy, yeah. Are you from the 70s, or like, where are you at? No, okay, you're getting hot. Where are you at? What's going on? Is she fingering you? What's happening?
So she's on.
You don't want to answer that question. I respect that. He's like, "I'm actually trying to tell a story. I'm not going to disrespect her or myself by playing your vulgar little game, sir." You want vulgarity? Go to the man in the V-neck sweater in the front row. How are you, sir? Okay, so you're hot and heavy. You're in there. Yeah.
So she's
on, two knuckles deep, and. By the way, are you with a date right now?
This is my fiance.
Does she know this story?
Yes, she knows.
Okay, cool. Good. Do you know what story he's about to tell? You have an idea. Oh, old dick jockey here has got a few tales to tell, does he? Okay. He's now asking her a question. I don't know how she plays.
Sorry.
So my fiance bursts in the room.
Sorry.
Okay. So you're hot and heavy.
So yeah, so she's kissing me and she notices.
Oh, you were hot and heavy. You guys were kissing? Oh, DJ. Okay.
She notices something off the side of the bed. There's a strap there.
A strap, just a strap.
We all
wanted there to be another word after strap, just so you know. Okay, so she notices in the corner there's a strap?
Of my bed, there's a strap. There's
like actually, a strap? Like a, or are you like from the streets? You're like, "I have my gap, my strap was right there." Because you never know, Claire. These streets, I hear you.
This did happen in Florida, so.
Okay, there's a lot of gunplay in Florida, I guess is the joke here.
So she
sees a strap.
There's a strap on... There,
strap
and then,
on there, comma. There's a strap, comma, on there. Okay. There's a strap over there. Let's go over. Let's say over.
And as we're looking, we notice there's a strap actually on every corner of the bed. That
this is your bed.
It's my bed.
What do you mean we notice? Oh, what the? Seems like somebody broke into my childhood bedroom and began a career in sadism and masochism. Well, well, well.
So we don't think anything of it, and we use them.
Okay. Oh, you tied her up.
She tied me up.
You freaking 18-year-old, you! What the hell?
So she tied me up, and then we end up having sex, and then we go out to go talk to my mom afterwards.
Sure. I mean, you didn't need to tell that part of the story. Well, we knew. What does one do after they fuck their ex-girlfriend? Mommy! We get it.
So she asks, "Oh, hey, did you find them?"
Your mother asks.
My mother asked that.
Did you find them?
I didn't know what to say. So I said yes.
You didn't know what she was asking?
No, I knew what she was asking.
Well, she said, did you find the straps I left?
Yeah, but she put it as like, did you find them?
Okay.
I come to find out that my mom is running a brothel out of my childhood bedroom during the week when I'm not there.
This is the best Airbnb ad I've ever heard. This is unreal. Wait a minute. So you're with your dad during the week?
I'm with my dad during the week.
What's your dad do? What's his deal?
My dad is a government contractor.
Okay, sure. That's what I wanted. I wanted the most boring thing possible. And your mom's just like, when DJ's away, mommy will play.
She was actually like one of the top Craigslist madams in South Florida.
Okay, I just want to put a pause in your story. For the listener at home, I promise you, there are no plants in here. I'm as surprised as you are right now. And the way that your mother, the manager at the bordello, decided to tell you, hey, by the way, I run a sex worker ring, was not, DJ, have a seat, I have to have a serious conversation with you. It's, hey, dog, did you find them? Yeah, the S&M straps I left in your childhood bedroom. So what did she say?
So she sits me, we had the conversation, and she that, very...
Yeah, the conversation. Classic.
She very nonchalantly tells me that she's running this during the week, and if I'm okay with that.
It's a little late, Mom. That's I came on them. Wait, what? Do your parents, where are they now?
So my parents are divorced. My mom's like a raging lesbian.
A raging one?
Like, yeah, she's just...
She's just like, give me some pussy, I'm hungry!
Yeah, she...
Oh, I like being gay! What do you mean raging?
She's just not casual about it.
She's like, not a casual lesbian. I thought lesbianism and being casual were kind of intricately linked or whatever. She's a more formal lesbian, you're saying.
She could go pro.
Hello, enchanté, and welcome.
So she sits me down. My girlfriend's there, too.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. I'm clocking her movements. So she's there, and your mom, how long have you been dating her?
We were dating for maybe a year and 6 months at that point.
Okay, and so your mom was like, she would want to know, too. I mean, that's the part that I don't understand, I'm having a hard time with, is why didn't she have a private...
Well, so, they're like, because of the relationship I was in...
What if he started crying? It'd be so good. I'd be so happy. I mean, I wouldn't. I want your joy to be...
No, I just was never away from my ex. Like, her and I were just kind of always together, so...
Right, you were in some ways tied together. Some booze and some applause. That's what maybe I'll call the album. Okay, so she says, I run a bordello out of your childhood bedroom.
Right.
And what came next? You, I guess.
I mean, I wanted to be like the cool, like hip son. I was like, okay.
It's so funny how the tables are turned here. I just wanted to be cool. I didn't want to be like a lame-o around my mom.
So I just said, okay, cool. Just make sure there's always condoms.
For what? For the customers? Well, what a conscientious man you are.
I just wanted to make sure that there was condoms in the room for me to use on the weekends.
Okay.
She said, okay. And that was the end of it. That was just...
And did you ever get tied up and fucked on your childhood bed again?
Yeah.
How about it for DJ, ladies and gentlemen? What a crazy story. I mean, now that was an epic tale.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.